Begin by saying good afternoon and thank you all for coming. I'm Ruth Katz, the very proud Dean of the School of Public Health and Health Services here at GW, and I want to welcome all of you to Public Health Grand Rounds. This event, as you may know now in its second year, has been attracting a terrific crowd, which we are again today, and we expect this to be a continuing tradition at the school in the years to come. Before we get started, let me provide a little background about this series for those of you who have not joined us before today. This year, we have built Grand Rounds around the theme of translating science into public health policy. We have had four stimulating sessions so far. Julie Gerberding, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, kicked off the series in September with a lively discussion about health policy and politics. After that, we brought in national experts to explore three very complex topics: why people with health insurance should care about people without it, how we can make public health policy decisions about chemical risks in the face of uncertainty, and what we need to do and to know about reducing health disparities. In their talks, our speakers helped us remember why scientific research in public health matters, not merely because it adds to our body of knowledge, but because it generates results that can be applied to real-world problems. Here at this school, GW School of Public Health, our strongest interest is in applied research, the kind of work that enables us to shape health policy and inform the law, identify best practices, and influence the structure and financing of our healthcare system. Doing all that demands the skills of numerous people. Public health professionals from many disciplines are essential, of course, but so are clinicians and bench scientists, as well as legislators, policymakers, and community advocates. That kind of multidisciplinary commitment is also reflected in the way we structure Grand Rounds at the School of Public Health, and it's one reason why we issue an open invitation to all of our lectures. Today's audience, for example, includes students and faculty at GW's Public Health School and Medical School, but we are also joined by many people from other units of the university. And we welcome community residents because we think their presence speaks directly to the very important role that public health plays in everyone's life. We hope you will join us at future Grand Rounds whenever you can. Our next event is scheduled for February 19th at noon in this very same auditorium, when we will combine Grand Rounds with the annual George Silver Lecture. That lectureship, housed in our Department of Health Policy, honors one of the great advocates of improving maternal and child health. We will be joined for that event by Dr. Philip Lee, who is truly a living legend in our field. Dr. Lee, a senior scholar at the University of California at San Francisco, served as Assistant Secretary of Health under the administrations of both President Bill Clinton and President Lyndon Johnson. Be sure to log on to the school's website at any time to see the upcoming schedule for Grand Rounds. As we get started, I'd also like to express my deepest gratitude to Pfizer for the support that makes Grand Rounds possible. Without Dr. Barbara DeBono, who has been Pfizer's champion for the series, we simply would not be able to do all that we do. We are also indebted to the Kaiser Family Foundation for helping us to both webcast and podcast this entire series so that we can share it with a much broader audience. Thanks to the Foundation's generosity, you can download any Grand Rounds event you may have to miss, and you'll be able to get today's event beginning tomorrow. That will be uploaded just almost as quickly as we finish. And now it is my very great pleasure to introduce our speaker this afternoon, Dr. Russell Pate. I was actually very fortunate to spend a little bit of time, at least over the phone, with Dr. Pate during the school's recent search for a new chair of our Department of Exercise Science. He was extremely helpful to me and to the school in general, and I'm delighted to say that our recruitment efforts have paid off very, very well. As some of you may already know, Dr. Loretta DiPietro, finally getting it correct, has signed on to leave her post at Yale University School of Public Health to become our new department chair. Dr. DiPietro is a friend and colleague of Dr. Pate's, and she is with us today. And Loretta, I'd ask you to just stand so that everyone can see our new department chair, Loretta will be joining us beginning this summer. We're delighted to have her on board. Dr. Russell Pate is Associate Vice President for Health Services at the University of South Carolina and Professor in the Department of Exercise Science at USC's Arnold School of Public Health. An exercise physiologist by training, he has devoted much of his career to trying to make us a healthier nation. Working with an expert panel convened by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Pate guided a review of the physiological, epidemiological, and clinical evidence linking physical activity to healthy living. That panel ultimately recommended, and I'm quoting here, that every U.S. adult should accumulate 30 minutes or more of moderate intensity physical activity on most, preferably all days of the week. Clearly, that is a goal as a nation we have yet to achieve. Dr. Pate also served on the U.S. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and Institute of Medicine panel, which developed recommendations for preventing childhood obesity. Here, too, I think we can all agree our country has much work to do. Fortunately, talented public health professionals like Dr. Pate are out there figuring out exactly how we can make progress. A past president of the American College of Sports Medicine and a member of the Science Board of the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports, Dr. Pate is an active researcher. He is also a remarkably prolific one with 170 scholarly papers to his credit, and that's in addition to authoring or editing 5 different books. Many of his investigations have been supported over the years by the National Institutes of Health and, of course, the CDC. Dr. Pate earned his MS and PhD degrees at the University of Oregon, and his work has been honored with a number of awards, including the Alliance Scholar Award of the American Alliance for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance. And I think you will not be entirely surprised to learn that Dr. Pate practices what he preaches, and then some. A lifelong distance runner, he competed in 3 U.S. Olympia trial marathons and twice placed among the top 10 finishers in the Boston Marathon. Wow. He does what he preaches. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Russell Pate.
Well, it really is a very great honor to be here. This is a very prestigious lecture series, and I'm truly honored to have been invited to be a part of it. And I'm thrilled that the timing is good and that Dr. DiPietro is here today. I commend both the school and her for her appointment, and very excited that she'll be coming here. We're, of course, only a few blocks from the White House, and a few more blocks from Congress, and So I'm delighted to be able to speak with you today about some policy issues that relate to my topic, which is promotion of physical activity for the purpose of obesity prevention in kids. I've been honored to serve in the last few years on several panels that have issued policy recommendations, and I assure you that where I'm heading with this talk is in the direction of telling you a bit about the recommendations of 2 of the panels that I was pleased to serve on. I'm going to take a few minutes before I get to that to develop the issue, and I'm going to start by asking you to just think with me for a few minutes about how much the society that we live in has changed. Now, some of you who are a little older and approximately my age have experienced probably more change than those of you who are the younger in the audience. But even for those of you that are at the low end of the age continuum in this audience, the world has changed. It's changed dramatically, and I think it's changed in many ways that have the effect of removing from our day-to-day lives the requirement to be physically active. And it's really been a double whammy, I think. In addition to removing the requirement to be active, a number of new barriers have arisen that probably make it more difficult to be physically active for those who are so inclined. So if you would, think a little bit about some of the changes that we've experienced. A clear one is in the area of how kids get to school. It's true that less than 15% of children in the 5 to 15-year age range now walk or ride bikes to school, as I'll show you in a moment. I think that's probably an overestimate. Only about 1% bike. And even for kids who live within a mile of school, the percentage of those that get to school by active transport is not very great. One of my most recent dissertations at USC was directed toward determining the percentage of kids that arrived at school by active transport, departed by active transport in the afternoon. And what was different about this study than most that have been done on this issue is that the method of data collection was direct observation. So John Sirard and the poor graduate students that he coerced into helping him with this project stood out in front of elementary schools in Columbia, South Carolina in the morning and the afternoon and observed, tallied how the kids got there, and this was the result. 5% walked, 1% got there by bike, and the rest got there by various modes, almost all of which involve motorized transportation. And so the data for morning arrival is in orange and for afternoon departure is in yellow. But if you see the high bars there are for bus and auto and van transport to aftercare centers and so on in the afternoon. We don't stack up too terribly well in the U.S. On this particular parameter. We're not a lot different than England, but as you can see, there are other countries in the world where kids do still get to school and back by active means, and that's not here. So, you know, you think, well, is that a big deal? Well, I'll come to something here in a moment that I think argues that maybe it is meaningful. Something else that's changed dramatically, of course, is the penetration of electronic entertainment in our lives, and I can't begin to overestimate for you how important I think this is in the issue that I'm here to talk with you about today. You can see that the percentage of homes that have at least one TV is basically all of them, and in my lifespan that has changed dramatically. I was in that little low bar on the left there when I was about 5 years old. We didn't have a TV yet. I think we got one the next year, maybe 1951. But there are, you know, virtually no homes that don't have them now. And lots of them have multiple TVs, of course, and lots of them have TVs in the rooms of the children. And sort of an interesting trend, this sort of makes the same point, that and lots of kids have TV in their own bedrooms. And this is the distribution of hours per day that kids in the U.S. Watch TV, and you can see that there are a lot of kids that are spending a lot of time watching TV. The orange sector there is 3 to 5 hours per day, and the green one is over 5 hours. So if you add those two up, that's, over 30%, around a third of kids watching more than 3 hours of TV per day. And, an interesting thing is that as other forms of electronic entertainment have become prevalent, video games and the internet and on and on and on, the amount of TV that kids watch has not declined. And so these additional forms of electronic entertainment, most of them quite inactive, have been layered on top of a form of electronic entertainment, TV watching, which has been common for quite some time. Concurrent with those trends, of course, everybody in this room knows that we've had a dramatic increase in the prevalence of overweight in American kids. And I know many in the room are somewhat used to looking at public health statistics for chronic disease risk factors, and I think you will probably agree with me that they don't usually change quite this dramatically. And we have had quite a remarkable increase in the prevalence of overweight just in the last 10 to 20 years. And, I'll leave it to you to decide whether you consider that to be a problem. There's certainly debates that we could have about how big a problem it is. I personally don't get too terribly energized about the direct negative health impact of moderate overweight. What concerns me is how people get overweight. And as I'm going to argue, I think that has a lot to do with physical inactivity and, of course, improper diet, which I'm not here to talk about today. And those two behavioral risk factors, I think we know, have multiple negative health consequences. So my point here is, before I leave this slide, you don't, in my view, have to be terribly concerned about the direct negative health impact of that trend to be very concerned about the health consequences for a population in which that's happened. Got to ask yourself, how do you get there? And I think it's by not being very physically active, probably in tandem often with improper diet. Now you can say, well, it's a pretty dramatic change, and can we do anything about it? Well, I think we can. My talk here today is premised on the basis of believing that we can, and but I think our chances of doing something about this are enormously greater if we deal with it from the prevention standpoint than if we let this problem develop and then try to handle it on the treatment side. And I never miss the opportunity to say what I'm going to say next, which is, I think, in the population in general, and I find often in professional groups, it's very hard to not sort of transfer over from the treatment side to conclusions about the overall relationship between activity and weight status. What I think the literature says is changing already existing overweight by behavioral or probably any other intervention is very difficult and usually a failure, despite what you will see in the bookstores or see on the TV advertising. The data all show about the same thing, which is treatment doesn't work very well. On the other hand, I think even though the science is limited, far more limited than I wish it was, I think there's every reason to believe that we can effectively deal with this problem at the public health level if we deal on the prevention side. So why do I think that? Well, I'm going to give you a little simple example here, and I'll put a few sort of caveats on it. I understand it's a simple example and that the whole relationship is more complicated than I'm going to lay it out here, but go with me anyway if you would. Think about a six-year-old child with a normal body mass index, 16 or so, corresponding to a percent body fat of about 12, weighs 22 kilograms. Somehow, 6 years later, this child now has a BMI over 28, corresponding to about 35% body fat, weighs 64 kilograms. We would consider normal weight as a six-year-old, probably substantially overweight as a 12-year-old. So what happened? Well, literally, this child gained 41 kilograms, and of course, you grow, you develop, you should gain weight. Not all of that would be excessive. The fat weight gain would be about 20 kilograms, and not all of that's abnormal. As you grow and add weight, you should add some fat weight. But if what we wanted was for this child to stay at about the same BMI as a 12-year-old, as he or she was as a 6-year-old, we would say that about 13 kilograms of that weight was excessive. So what's that mean? Well, that fat mass corresponds to about 100,000 kilocalories of energy. And if that was something that you were going to try to dispose of in a month or two so that you'll be ready to go to the beach, you would have a big problem on your hands. That's probably not going to happen in any way that we would consider healthy. Corresponds to about 16,000 kilocalories per year, about 300 kilocalories per week, but only about 46 calories per day. Now, I think you see where I'm going with this. What would be an enormous amount of energy to dispose of if you were going to try to dispose of it on the treatment side in a relatively short period of time is really not an enormous amount of energy when expressed as excess calories per day if you're thinking of it on the prevention side. Now, what's 46 calories? Well, I promise you, for most kids, it would be less than the energy expenditure associated with walking to and from school every day. It's also, what, maybe an Oreo, right, on the dietary side. So my point here is that at least in theory, if we think about dealing with this problem on the prevention side, this need not be seen as an insurmountable problem. Now, the catch, of course, is that's not 46 extra calories expended for a day or two. That was 46 calories expended every day for 6 years. So we're not talking about a short-term intervention. We're talking about a different lifestyle. And the lifestyle we're now living in this culture is not the lifestyle we used to live. And it's a lifestyle that demands a lot less energy expenditure. Personally think we're paying the price for it, and we've got to figure out what to do. How active do we think kids should be? Well, I've served on a few panels that have tried to provide an answer to this, and I'll be the first to tell you that I think our science base is not as extensive as I wish it was answering this question. We're working on this right now again. The first U.S. physical activity guidelines are in development right now under the auspices of the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm honored to be involved in this. Dr. DiPietro is involved as well. And so we're again confronting this particular question of how active we think people should be. I think for kids, the current recommendation, and I subscribe to this, is this one. It says that school-age kids should participate every day in 60 minutes or more of moderate to vigorous physical activity that's enjoyable and developmentally appropriate. Now, I think we need to continue to test that recommendation. We need more science that will contribute to the underpinning of such a guideline. But to make a long story short, I think this is a reasonable recommendation given the data that exists at the present time. Well, how active are kids? So keep that 60-minute per day moderate to vigorous physical activity guideline in mind. Well, it depends on how you ask the question. Our only regularly administered public health surveillance system in the U.S. that addresses this directly is the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Now, there are some other developments in play that I hope are going to help us track this in the future a little better. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey is completed by a national sample of high school kids on odd-numbered years. It has a few questions that query physical activity participation. And one of those asks kids if they think they get 60 minutes of physical activity per day. And you see the percentages that respond positively to that. It's about 40% of boys, about a third of girls. If you then query participation in vigorous activity 3 or more days per week or 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity per day, you see that the percentages that meet that guideline are higher. I don't believe those data, okay? I'm going to show you. I don't think that's right, okay? And I think it's because it's very difficult for kids to to respond to questions. Oh, people, not just kids, people. But I just don't believe that data is accurate. And there's a process in play right now that I hope is going to result in dealing with this a little better. Fortunately, we have had a considerable change in the way in which we're now measuring physical activity, at least in research settings and to some extent in surveillance settings. We've had the development of accelerometry, development of little electromechanical devices that are motion sensors. Data can be stored for extended periods of time. Usually when we use them, we have kids wear them for a week. The data can be stored in relatively short time increments. Some data I'll show you in a moment here were collected in 30-second increments for a week. So you can objectively monitor physical activity now using these devices. Now, I'll show you. These are not miraculous. There are issues with their application in this situation, but I do think they're a big improvement over self-report. One study that our group at South Carolina has been involved in for the last several years is called TAG, Trial of Activity in Adolescent Girls, which is a multi-center study involving six universities. We used accelerometers to measure physical activity in a fairly large number of sixth grade girls at baseline in this study. And this is the cities where the data were collected: Tucson, San Diego, New Orleans, here in the D.C., Baltimore area, Minneapolis, and then Columbia. We have data in about 1,500 sixth grade girls. And for this audience, I'll take just a minute to say that in order to reduce accelerometry data, it's necessary to decide how you're going to establish cut points for reduction of the data. So what happens is these devices log on a 30-second or 1-minute increment, quote, counts, right? Well, a count is meaningless in this context, right? We're not really interested in counts. We're interested in how active the child is during each of those 30-second increments, and so we have to convert counts to intensity of activity. There are different ways of doing this. Our group and a few other groups around the country have worked a lot on developing methods for reducing accelerometry data to determine the intensity of activity participation. Bottom line, the TAG data are shown here. And the big red sector is inactive, about 55.7% of the observation time kids were sedentary. When they were active, it was almost always light activity, meaning kind of the equivalent of slow moving. The moderate sector you can see is the orange one, and the green sector is vigorous, and you can see they don't represent a very large percentage of the day. So if you add those two together, 18 and 5 is 23, 24 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity per day in this rather diverse sample of sixth grade girls. Now bump that up against the standard of 60 minutes per day, you can see that not many of them got near there, and they didn't. This is the percentage of those girls in the TAG data that met different presentations of physical activity guidelines. So if you take the standard approach to reducing the data that we used in TAG and apply a 60-minute guideline, it's that little low yellow bar on the left, which basically says almost none of them got 60 minutes of activity per day. If you tinker with the guideline or you tinker with the way in which you reduce the data, you can get different answers. And I'm not here to create cognitive dissonance. It's a university. It's a scholarly audience. You know, you need to be able to tolerate the fact that, you know, we don't have all the answers yet. And we've got more work to do to figure out how to reduce these data. I'll have to say, having worked with these data a good bit, it's those bars over on the left that I think are the real ones. And you can get other answers if you want to play with the data. But that's my personal opinion. Not very many kids are getting 60 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity per day. I've also worked collaboratively with investigators on other applications of accelerometry, and I'll just quickly show you data that are a few years old now from collected in Amherst, the public schools in Amherst, Massachusetts. And I show you this just to make the point that there's a tremendous age-related decline in activity. These are kids in Amherst, Mass., ranging in age from the primary elementary grades on the left to the upper elementary grades, to middle school, to on the right, high school age. The percentage meeting that 60-minute guideline using slightly different ways of reducing the data. And you can see that in those data, by the time they're in high school, it's down around a quarter of kids that were meeting that standard. I personally think probably not quite that high. Now, you know, I guess I'll leave it to you to decide whether you think that's a problem or not. There are people stashed away in universities around the country that have studied age-related change in activity in just about every species there is. And it's not an oddity that activity level declines with increasing age. The issue is, how steep is that decline? And I'll just tell you, I think it's too steep and steeper than it used to be, in all probability. So what are we going to do about it? Well, I don't have time today to tell the whole story about that, but clearly there are people who are working on interventions in a range of settings. I think most of what we've done in the past and most of what we know is based on studies that have been done in the school setting. I'll tell you about one study that my group's been involved in here in a moment. But clearly we need to know a lot more than we do now about how to promote activity in the full range of settings where kids spend a lot of time. And that clearly includes home, where we don't know very much right now about how to promote activity there. And I don't think we're going to win this battle if we don't figure that one out. But there's been a little work in community settings, some in healthcare settings. There have been some attempts working through media campaigns. I'm going to tell you about one study that our group's been involved in for over a decade. We call it LEAP, Lifestyle Education for Activity Program. And we started with girls that were matriculating to 24 high schools distributed across the state of South Carolina. They were eighth graders at the time when we measured them at baseline. There were about 1,600 of them. And in the public schools in South Carolina, the kids are about 50-50 African-American, white, small percentages of other race, ethnicity groups. We randomly assigned the schools, not the kids, the schools, to intervention and control. At that time, we were working primarily with self-report measures of activity, and we used one that our group has developed called the 3-Day Physical Activity Recall to measure activity in these kids. We exposed the girls in the intervention schools to a multi-component intervention. It was coordinated by the school personnel, headed by almost always a woman who was the lead PE teacher in the high school. We called her the LEAP champion. The LEAP team included a number of other school personnel that coordinated this. Our university-based interventionists worked with the folks in the schools who in turn delivered the intervention. We made major changes in the PE program, the health education program, school services, school environment, and there were a few pieces that connected to family and community components. I'll tell you a little bit about LEAP PE. I'm going to bet that there are a few women in the audience who were less than thrilled with their high school physical education experience. My roots are in the field of physical education, I don't mind telling you, and my colleagues and I just simply believe we can do better than that, you know, that we can provide an approach to physical education that, that these young women will enjoy, that will result in their developing confidence in their ability to be physically active, as well as develop some motor skills and make connections to out-of-school community physical activity opportunities. Cut to the bottom line, when we followed up with these girls toward the end of their ninth grade year, the girls in the intervention schools were significantly more likely to meet a vigorous physical activity standard than girls in the control schools. Now, I'll leave it to you to decide whether that differential is meaningful. What I will point out is that girls did not volunteer to be exposed to the intervention. If they were in the intervention schools, they were exposed. Now, they did, of course, have to consent to participate in the measurement component of the study. But this was, we think, a public health intervention. It was implemented in the school by school personnel for the purpose of changing the physical activity, social environment in the schools. And we think it resulted in the girls in those schools being more active than girls in the control schools. And if we then subsequently subdivided the intervention schools into those that did the best job of implementing the intervention based on an independent process evaluation, those in the schools that did the best job of implementing the intervention were more active than those in the other intervention schools, both groups still more active than those in the control schools. And collected a lot of other information on these kids, and if we then look at some of the factors that we thought were targets of the intervention, perhaps likely to help explain the intervention effect, and we then apply structural equation modeling to that data, what we find is that the effect of the intervention, as observed in these kids as ninth graders, is at least partially explained by their enjoyment, increased enjoyment of physical education, increased enjoyment of physical activity, and an enhancement, to use a little jargon here, of their physical activity self-efficacy or their sense of confidence or competence with regard to physical activity. Now, those factors didn't explain the whole intervention effect. Some of it is not explained by factors that we measured. But I guess my basic message to you is I think this hangs together. And I don't have a slide to show it, but we have recently followed up with these girls as 12th graders. And frankly, surprising to me, the girls in the intervention schools where our process evaluation performed when they were 12th graders indicated that the intervention was still in place, those girls are more active than girls in the other schools. And that finding was just recently published. So what's the message here? I think the message is we can make changes in a public setting like a school, and it influences kids' behavior in the direction that we would like to influence it. So my point is not that this is going to win the whole battle. It probably isn't going to win the whole battle independently, but I think it's at least encouraging that that we can have an influence on a health behavior like physical activity through interventions operated in the school. So, as Dr. Katz mentioned in her introduction, I did have the opportunity just a few years ago to serve on an Institute of Medicine panel that produced a fairly voluminous report on preventing childhood obesity. It's called Health in the Balance. And it made quite a number of recommendations, many of which dealt with diet, many of which dealt with physical activity. I'm going to tell you only about the physical activity recommendations that were included in this report. I'll preface this by saying that this was a very diverse group of people that worked on this, served on this panel. Some had been, in important government positions. Some had been in state health departments. Some were academicians. Some were in the private sector, in media settings and corporate settings. Very diverse group of people. We didn't agree on much of anything quickly, I can tell you. And it was not that it wasn't a very collegial group, but, people felt strongly, and we battled it out a lot. But there was one thing we agreed on quickly, and it was that if our report was going to be based strictly on highly developed scientific evidence, it wasn't going to be much of a report. So I would say that the recommendations that I'm going to show you here are probably best described as evidence-informed, but I wouldn't claim that they are all evidence-based in the hardcore scientific sense of that term. My personal belief is we have to revisit these things from time to time. We have to do the science and then take another look at these recommendations, but I don't think it makes sense to just sort of wait until we think the science has gotten to the desired point, and then start talking about what to do. This report included policy recommendations in 10 areas, ranging from national priority down to changes that would play out in the home. I argued for reversing the order. I lost. I thought we should start with the home recommendations and work out, but that didn't fly. But the content, I think, would have been the same in either case. So I'm going to give you just sort of a quick overview here of what was recommended in these different areas. this group thought hard about this and is well aware of, you know, sort of current political predispositions and so on, and came down hard on the idea that government is going to have to commit to this. Not alone, as you see. We got a lot of recommendations in other areas, but you know, I think the basic sense of this group is that you know, we're dealing with an ocean liner, and that baby's not going to turn without you know, some real influence. We've not gotten where we are quickly. We've not gotten where we are by, you know, just a couple of little changes here and there. Our culture has changed, and it's produced the effect that we're seeing. And to turn that is not going to be easy, and it's not going to be quick, and it's going to take leadership. And so this group did come down pretty hard on the idea that federal, state, and local governments are going to have to provide leadership. This is the U.S. The private sector matters, and we talked a lot about the role of industry. I personally think that if we're going to solve this problem, industry is going to have to be part of the solution. I see some encouraging trends. But on the physical activity side, frankly, the sporting goods industry and the entertainment industry have sort of gotten a pass on this. But we are starting to see, you know, some encouraging trends, you know, Dance Dance Revolution and Wii and, you know, more active video games are now in the marketplace, seem to be doing okay so far. Hopefully this is an early indication of, a change in industry approaches to dealing with this issue. It's another whole story, of course, about the food industry that I'm not here to talk about today. They're going to have to be community programs. You know, the criticism I have of our approaches to dealing with this issue up to this point is they're scattered. I'd like to know about a community where there's somebody in charge of this issue. You know, of thinking about all the kids that live in that community and whether or not they're as physically active as they ought to be. I don't know that it's ever been approached that way. And I think it's going to have to be. You know, I think we're going to have to come together at the community level and think about what we're going to do about this. You know, I think, as I've said, there's a place for federal and state government. But we all know, I mean, kids live at the community, neighborhood, home, school level. And for the changes to matter, they're going to have to make it to that level. And so I think communities are going to have to come together on this. We've spent a lot of time in recent decades building a physical environment in this country that basically doesn't require us to be physically active, puts up a lot of barriers to our being physically active. And I'd like to think that this issue is starting to turn. Certainly we hear a lot more about the built environment, and there have been some important research initiatives in this area in recent years. But it, you know, frankly, it's going to take a long time to retrofit our communities to be more conducive to physical activity. Let's face it, we spent decades building sprawling suburbs that where people are almost totally dependent upon motorized transportation. And, you know, we're now going to have to figure out a way to kind of work ourselves out of the problems associated with that configuration of our communities. But there's certainly a lot of people thinking and working on this one, and at least some encouraging trends. I've already said a good bit about schools. I think schools will have to be part of the solution. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. I don't think it's fair, though, to say that the schools ought to solve this problem for us. I don't think they can. I think the schools can help. They should help. One recommendation included in the IOM report is that if kids are going to get 60 minutes of activity per day, they ought to get 30 of those minutes during the school day on a school day. It's a little hard to think that, you know, most kids are going to get 60 minutes if they're dead sedentary all day. Now, the kind of reflexive response to the childhood obesity problem that you hear a lot is, okay, it's a problem, let's increase PE and get vending machines out of the school. Well, okay, you know, both of those might help a little bit. neither of those implemented in spades is going to solve this problem. Okay, I'll just tell you what I think. I think they might be important contributors if we did it right, but we got to think a little more broadly about this. I think schools have an important role to play. I'll tell you more in just a moment about that. And I don't think we could hope to solve this problem without figuring out how to help parents make changes in the home environment. I think parents have got to be promoters of regular physical activity in their kids. I think they've got to encourage and support activity. I think they got to put the quietus on screen time. And, the American Academy of Pediatrics says 2 hours a day. I'd personally like to be a little more draconian and say, well, an hour a day is probably plenty. And, that'll give you a little room to fudge, I guess, if you do. But, we've just got to stop what's going on. I mean, it's just endless hours of, of TV and video games and the Internet and texting and on and on and on. And, next week it'll be another sedentary innovation that'll be available and will sweep through the culture. I don't remember much about what I did to entertain myself when I was 4 years old, but I know it wasn't watch TV, get on the Internet, and none of that stuff existed. And one of my seat-of-the-pants theories about activity in kids is a huge driver is boredom avoidance, right? How many times have you heard your kids say, I'm bored, I'm bored? Well, kids don't like to be bored. Well, what do they have to do to not be bored today? Well, right, surf, through 20 channels that are aimed right at their demographic. And when that gets boring, get on the Internet. When that gets boring, you get my drift, on and on and on. They don't have to go out the door. And, one of the strongest predictors of how active a kid is whether he or she is inside or outside. Kids spend way too much time inside, not nearly enough time outside today. Finally, I'll tell you about one other policy initiative that was undertaken recently under the auspices of the American Heart Association. And this panel focused heavily on a leadership role for schools in promoting activity in kids. And there were a few recommendations, which I'll mention quickly. One is that 30-minute activity target be met by kids in schools on the typical school day, and that they can reach that guideline in a number of ways. A second recommendation is that we should provide kids with so-called health-related physical education programs that meet national standards. I've been around physical education for a long, long time. I come from a long line of physical educators in my family. I think it's, a remarkable profession, but it pains me to see how poorly it is done sometimes. I stay interested in it because I see great programs that would just, make your heart feel wonderful. When it's done well, it is just such a great thing for kids. But it's done poorly way too often, and we've simply got to help the schools apply better standards. One approach is to make sure that those who deliver physical education in the schools are properly trained and certified. There needs to be better accountability. I got to tell you, No Child Left Behind did not help, because physical education and health education were left out of it. If you're a school principal, And your scorecard is going to be in the newspaper in 6 months. What are you going to worry about? The things that contribute to that score or the things that don't? It's just human nature. And so we've got to have better accountability for physical education. We've got to expand physical activity opportunities in and around the schools. There may be a few people in this room that remember intramurals. Not very common anymore, but, could be. We need further diversification, I think, of interscholastic sports programs, but there has been growth there. You can all see that I have a doctoral student who's a dancer, helped me put together these slides. And there are many other clubs and lessons and approaches to activity that that kids could be provided with in the school setting. And we've got to promote active transport to and from school. of course, work with local governments to ensure that that's safe. And this doesn't start in first grade. Millions of American children are in child development centers and preschools. And, you know, my group has been focusing on studies in preschools for a few years now. And I can tell you that a lot of kids are not very active in preschools. And I think we've got to do a better job with the provision of health education programs, which generally are not very well received by kids, partly because I think they don't focus on the right things, which are the behavioral skills that kids need in order to develop an active lifestyle. And finally, of course, it's the colleges and universities like ours that train professionals to provide these programs, and we've probably got to do a better job of that. I think that you know, we're probably not quite in the 21st century yet in the way in which we are preparing people to work in this area, and I think we've got to make changes. I'll finish by so I'm here in School of Public Health, which I consider to be my natural environment. I'll finish with a public health message. You know, I think that for those of us that are concerned about physical activity, you know, I think that we're enormously proud that, that physical activity does now have a place in, you know, in the public health domain in this country. But, you know, as proud as I think we can be of that, we're not where we need to be. This is a huge problem. I don't like to be alarmist, but, you know, there are some folks that make a pretty credible argument that this is one of the great public health challenges of the 21st century, and it's going to take a strengthening of the public health infrastructure to deal effectively with this problem. Again, it's a real honor to be here today, and I thank you very, very much for your attention. Thank you.
Questions? I'll let you pause.
Sure.
I enjoyed your talk. Thank you. I think also that mental health, depression, ADHD is what happens. It's all interconnected. But my question is, my son goes to school in Montgomery County, which is one of the richest counties in the country. They have gym once a week.
What's the national norm?
In elementary school. What can we do on the grassroots levels, I mean, to get them to think at least 3 or 4 days? I mean, what do people do? I agree with you, but where do you start on that parental level?
You know, I think that, frankly, we've come off of several decades during which physical education has generally eroded across the country. But I really do believe that that started to turn around, you know, just a few years ago. And we have now seen a number of states that have have implemented state-level policies for the schools with regard to physical education. In some cases, that has provided substantial increases in funding for physical education. This is a little easier politically at the elementary level, and so, you know, I wouldn't want to say that this is all happening quickly, but there are signs around the country that, you know, that things have turned and that policymakers who, you know, who determine what goes on in the schools are recognizing that, you know, it's going to take an investment to change this. I mean, just think about it. if the norm in a school district now is that kids in the elementary schools have physical education with a, you know, with a trained physical educator, maybe 30, 35 minutes a week, and you're going to triple that, well, you're not that's not a minor investment for a school district. That's three times as many teachers. It's three times as much space and equipment and so on. So, you know, it does come down to resources. That's why some of the recommendations about how schools can deal with this problem have emphasized, in addition to increasing physical education exposure, other strategies such as increased activity in classroom learning settings, protecting recess, increasing active transport to and from school, increased extracurricular programs, because quite frankly, markedly increasing exposure to physical education is a fairly expensive proposition for schools and school districts.
But would you write your congressman? I mean, where do people start that would feel it's important?
Most of educational policy in this country is created at the state level. So I think it's the state education departments that and the state legislatures that really will have the influence on this. You know, districts have some latitude, but it really is state-level policy that has the big impact. Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you for a very enlightening presentation. Obesity and poor physical fitness has become an important domain in health disparities in the United States, with immediate consequences and long-term consequences. I know that you have that at heart, but could you speak to us a little bit about the variable of the ecological model and physical fitness?
Sure.
Children in the District of Columbia living in neighborhoods where their life would be endangered for leaving their homes and playing out on the street, I'm not going to follow your recommendations.
Yeah. And you know, that's a very legitimate concern. And, you know, I always try to phrase this carefully because, you know, the last thing any of us want to do is run around pitching recommendations that will place kids at risk. So I don't want to do that. So let me try to say this in a way that conveys what I'm really thinking. If we take this at the societal level, I'm confident saying that most kids should spend more time outside being physically active. That said, clearly there are neighborhoods in which that's not a safe approach to dealing with the problem. And in communities like that, I think that our public institutions like schools and community centers, the Ys and the Boys and Girls Clubs and so on, are going to have to play an even greater role than they may need to play in, you know, in the safe suburbs where, you know, maybe it's perfectly fine for kids to be outside more. You know, as I've said earlier, kids aren't outside very much. I mean, I go through my neighborhood. There are a lot of young families, young kids live in the neighborhood where I do. I one little girl lives about two blocks down. I see her out shooting baskets in the driveway occasionally. You know, I sometimes run in the morning. Kids are going to the elementary school that's right in the middle of the neighborhood, perfectly safe for them. I see one little girl trudging up the sidewalk with her roller, you know, thing, and you know, she's the only one. I want to stop and interview her some morning, you know, because I thought I could get away with it without being, you know, accused of being strange. And I'd like to know what's going on in her little head because she's the only one, you know, and. We've got to change that social norm around that. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for talking. I think having grown up in the 50s myself and seeing how my parents have changed, or what it was like then and now with my kids, the thing that has really struck me about physical activity, aside from what is not being done in the school, is the cost of physical activity after the school. Mm-hmm. And the financing of your child being in a quasi-organized system, be it a rec system or even a more than a rec system, a county system. I watch the kids in my son's school. The kids who can afford it will do after. The kids mm-hmm. who can't afford it stay home with their grandparents. And I think that there's a financing issue that's driven by some social inequities that in some ways I think is underpinning to some of what we see in terms of inequity.
Absolutely agree. In many ways, I think we've privatized this service, you know, and the kids that have resources can, you know, can get dance lessons and can have Y memberships and you know, can be transported to programs to take part. And kids whose families don't have those resources can be left out. That's one reason why I argue that we've got to think about this at the community level and think about all the kids in those communities as to whether or not they're being served by the programs that are available. You know, one other point, you know, I have mixed feelings about, you know, the whole youth sport trend. You know, because you know, you could look at that and you'd say, well, there's been growth there, and there has been, you know, and you know, you think about youth soccer and so on, and I'd much rather have a kid in one of those programs mm-hmm. than you know, laying at home, you know, surfing the internet, But I do worry sometimes that parents who are intending to do the right thing, you know, sign their kids up for a youth sport program and check the box off. Say, well, I've done my duty, you know. Johnny signed up for soccer. Well, you think about how much activity a kid gets if the soccer program is pretty typical, you know, practice on Wednesday night and a game on Saturday morning. You know, how many minutes of moderate to vigorous activity does that alone add up to? So I'm not arguing against those programs. I'd rather see kids in those programs than not. I just want parents and other responsible adults to understand that, you know, there isn't going to be a silver bullet. You know, signing a kid up for that kind of program is a good thing to do usually, but that alone is not going to solve the problem. You see in these policy recommendations, people are talking about triangulating on this issue from a lot of different angles, and I do think that's probably what it's going to take.
In your presentation, you extended the data and the consideration to adolescents, but you didn't speak about body image and about issues of negative body image attached to obesity and the threshold of going too far the other way and all of the other issues. How do you navigate that treacherous terrain?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, the question has to do with, with body image, and we do have a balance to strike between, helping kids develop the behaviors that we think will help them maintain an appropriate body composition, and yet do it in a way that won't exacerbate a problem that we sometimes have with, glamorizing a sort of an ideal body form, or for that matter, coming across as discriminatory against kids that are overweight. I mean, you've got issues on both ends of the continuum, in my mind, the appropriate approach to this is to focus on the behaviors and the factors that influence the behaviors, physical activity in my case, but diet as well, and not emphasize, body shape and body weight and body form in that context. I mean, the way I think of it is, activity is good for kids sort of regardless of where they are across that whole body composition continuum. And the percentage of kids that are, that really have an underlying mental health problem and are essentially using excessive exercise, in that context is tiny. Where it exists, we should help kids get the assistance that they need. But, from a public health standpoint, I do think we've got to hold up an active lifestyle as an appropriate way to live. Yes?
Thank you for your comments. Sure. In your presentation, you mentioned five or six domains in which physical activity, which could increase physical activity, like home, school. And one of them was healthcare. Mm-hmm. What do you suggest that the healthcare providers do to increase?
Yeah, thank you. It has to do with the role of healthcare providers. I appreciate your asking. There have really only been a handful of studies undertaken to test interventions operating in the healthcare environment to promote physical activity. And I think there's a need for a lot more work. There is some encouragement in that science, but it's I think awfully preliminary at this point. My bite, here's a free idea. I'll probably never get around to studying this, but here's one for you to try. We all know that patients spend a quite modest amount of time in direct contact with a physician or other healthcare provider when they come through, let's say, a pediatric practice. I personally don't think it's realistic to expect the physician to transform a child's physical activity behavior, in a 2-minute interaction. what I do believe physicians and other healthcare providers can do that would be very important is appropriately screen and appropriately link kids through their parents to school and community-based programs that can help address the need that they have. And what I would like to see tested is an approach to clinically-based intervention that would essentially bridge that gap between the physician practice and the community providers of services that could help address this issue in kids. Most of the interventions that have been tested so far have essentially tested intervention strategies that have played out in the office practice per se. And I just think to be effective, you know, the influence of what goes on in that physician office is going to have to extend, you know, further out into the child's life. Yes.
Well, in infectious disease epidemiology, some of the most beneficial interventions have focused on the vehicles and vectors that spread the agents. And so it's amazed me that we haven't gotten there yet in, you know, trying to promote physical activity. We have all these vehicles and vectors of disuse. We have cell phones, remote controls, revolving or escalators, elevators. Why haven't we started focusing on that? If every home threw out the remote, I guarantee that television time is reduced. Take, you know, every kid has a cell phone in the group. Maybe we should start targeting those things in addition to what you are suggesting.
I think two reactions to that. Of course, people do make those recommendations. What we haven't gotten to are effective strategies for acting on those recommendations. So we've got to figure out how to, in the context of kids, penetrate the family, influence the parent in ways to modify those specific behaviors. So that's one comment. The other one is we're not going to dial back the clock to 1950. Okay, so that's gone. We're not going to go back and live that way. So we've got to be figuring out ways that will be realistic in our current society. And I think part of that is going to be to figure out how to use some of these innovations to shape child behavior in the directions that we want. And as I know you know, there are people thinking about interventions that operate through some of these media channels. And, you know, I don't have time to talk about it today, but, you know, the youth media campaign, the Verb campaign. If you had kids a few years ago that were in the tween age range, you may not have known what Verb was, but they did because it was out there, and it was subjected to a very substantial evaluation. And I was sort of a skeptic, I'll have to tell you, but it looks like it had some influence. And but it was funded by Congress at a quite substantial level, which these things usually aren't, and that one was. And when the appropriation ran out, the program died. It wasn't continued, which I can't tell you how unfortunate and ironic I think that is, because the darn thing looked like it was working. But it was. It was a retirement gift to a congressman who was, rotating out of Congress at a time when Congress had a lot of money laying around. And so that's what he said he wanted as a going-away gift, and it got appropriated, sent to CDC. They figured this program out. Darned if it didn't look like it worked. So, you know, I think there's room for some optimism that we can work through these media channels that didn't even exist some time ago in ways to have a positive impact on kids' behavior.
This will be the last one.
I'm from Canada, and we face a lot of the same problems in Canada. And something that I've noticed is that, ironically, as children are increasingly being driven to school, that actually creates a more unsafe environment. And kids don't want to walk to school because there are so many vehicles around the schools. And I'm wondering if you have any specific programs successful in actually increasing safety in the sort of perimeter around schools so that more kids, or more parents, I guess, can feel encouraged to let their kids walk to school?
I don't know of an example, but thank you for bringing that up, because I've taken to saying that to me it would be just a wonderful national commitment to say that we're going to take, you name it, the half mile around every school in this country and commit to having that be a healthy, health-promoting environment, not only from the physical activity standpoint, but from the nutrition and tobacco use and, you run down the list of important health behaviors. I would just like to see us take that on as a society, because I think, I think it would have an influence. But I'm not aware. I don't want to say it doesn't exist. It may well exist. I just don't know of a specific example in which that's been taken on. You could imagine, a situation in which, even though most kids are bused to a particular school because they live too far from the school to walk there, they could be dropped off a half mile away, if it's not a driving rainstorm on a, on a given day, and walk the rest of the way in. I mean, there's no reason why that couldn't be the norm, but it sure isn't today. That school I told you about in my own neighborhood recently reconfigured the parking lots so that there's now a loop where the SUVs kind of cruise through smoothly, and pop the kid out, and just keep on moving. It's a long line of SUVs. It's just pathological. Thank you all very much.